Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. This is Bob Dumo, your host for The Buzz on Technical Rescue. During today's session, we'll be talking about mine rescue teams and their various operations. Joining me today for this session is Rick Hickman. Rick's a safety manager with Morton Salt. He's been involved in various aspects of mine rescue since 1971. Rick's presently on the board of directors for the National Mine Rescue Association. Rick, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure to be able to talk about mine rescue, something I hold dear to my heart, and the people that are involved in mine rescue. Lot of unsung heroes out there.
And I think that really starts it off well. It's one of those specialties that fortunately we don't see very often on the news. The incidents are very infrequent, but when things do happen, it's usually quite a tragic situation your people are called to assist with and sometimes actively involved. As we talk, we'll find out a little bit more of just where the team members come from and how intimately involved they would be in the mine's operations. Being involved since 71, you've probably seen many changes over the years. Any one specific change or activity stand out in your mind?
I think one of the changes has been in the equipment, the breathing apparatus that the team members wear. People can go online to www.msha.gov and look at the history, if they're interested, of the various equipment as it started out with just a tube, and then somebody invented a breathing bag. And then one of the instruments that I started out with in breathing apparatus in 71 was called a McKay. And for the time, it did quite a good job. And then a German company, who was also involved in some of the early development, Dräger, developed several different apparatus. And the one that I wore the most of was a Dräger BG-174. And lots and lots of improvements in the breathing apparatus. That machine had a one problem was that it wasn't positive pressure, which meant that if the mine rescue guy was in a gassy atmosphere and he broke a seal on his face piece, then outside atmosphere could get in. The newer model apparatus is called a Dräger BG4, and they have even a third generation of that. It's positive pressure, but I guess to back up to the simple answer to the question, it's been the apparatus that the team wears, and the other one is the use of the instrumentation for measuring gaseous atmospheres. We know in the early history of mining, everybody associates canary, and the canaries were used actually in cages to determine, you know, oxygen deficiency, whether or not it was okay for rescuers to go in, and they really didn't have good breathing apparatus. But it's developed now to where several different companies have instruments that will read up to, you know, six different gases, and they're all computerized, and it just makes the mine rescue guy's job more informative.
I think that's key, having a tool that's going to give you the answers to create a safer work environment. Talking a little bit about the breathing systems you use, provides the same service that a traditional structural firefighter would wear, but actually a much more advanced piece of equipment. Your time durations are extensively longer, correct?
Exactly. Most machines today require 4 hours of breathing. Of course, that's a medical grade, aviator grade oxygen. And I can safely say from experience, depending upon the size, the shape of the person that they're in, the stress level, people don't realize that when that adrenaline flow starts, you know, you're going to be pumping more oxygen and draining your system. But a good four-hour system in a person that's in fairly reasonable health in heavy work and high adrenaline flow, you're going to have about 3 hours left in that machine.
So we're looking at a very safe and positive piece of equipment, but also we start looking at to be able to keep an individual on air for 3+ hours, fatigue factor has to be big. So the efficiency of what you do when you train and do your different exercises to prepare your teams has to be key on that longevity. You don't have the luxury of a second wave sitting 100 yards away.
Right, exactly. And the teams that I've trained and the guys that I'm training now, I try to associate with them, you know, a normal day's training at the mine site, whatever we do, is at X level. Now they're preparing for competition this week, and that raises the bar a little bit. But I also do a training session at a simulated mine lab with smoke, and, you know, I can have a live fire and those kinds of things. But that's not up to the real level, you know, of a real fire. So yeah, and a lot of people overlook the adrenaline flow that happens, and I know being a member of the NFPA, you know, reading fatalities of firefighters, you know, the physical shape of that person when you get the stress level, the adrenaline flow, what can actually happen to guys.
Right, and a second thing that, you know, folks in the mine rescue community deal with that traditionally the fire service doesn't have as much on a regular basis is the emotional side, where if an incident happens at your facility, these are your coworkers. Very often you can have a community member, a family member or something in a traditional neighborhood or community-based fire service. But here the odds are everybody will know one another to one degree or greater. So you start looking at all the secondary factors that impact one of the rescuers when they're called upon.
Right.
That has to be another challenge you have to deal with.
Right. I know the most recent disaster that's been in the news in southern West Virginia, you know, I grew up there. I lived there. I knew some of those guys that were lost in that basic tragedy. And, you know, when I was growing up, I grew up in a coal community. And it's different from a city or a suburban environment where people may not know their next-door neighbor. But in that type of environment, you know, the camaraderie of the people there, and a lot of people don't understand that, you know, they are together. They work together. And like you say, it may be family members. And I've known guys that have been on mine rescue teams to go in and, you know, there's an uncle or a brother or a cousin or their father even that was involved in that. And it creates a definite emotional high and adds to the stress level of the rescuer.
Now, with these rescue teams, do all mines have an in-house rescue team, or does that vary from location to location?
Okay, government regulations under 30 CFR Part 49, which is that section of the law under mining that relates to mine rescue teams, there are a couple options out there. Regulations basically require 2 mine rescue teams for each mine, but also there's an option there that if they don't have, if it's in the same company or a different company, they can combine and have a traveling team, if you will, to cover both of those mines as long as they're within an hour, hour and a half travel distance to the other mine. Requirements include them to train at that other mine, be familiar with, you know, the layout of the mine, the ventilation system, and those kinds of things.
I think, and training is the key component, no matter if we're doing structural firefighting, aircraft firefighting, mine rescue. The training needs are so imperative for our folks to do well.
Right.
The teams you come to these competitions with or have in the mines, what's the traditional staffing for a team?
Okay, as I said, that Part 49 requires a minimum of 6 men on a team. You'll have a captain, 2 persons that will be responsible for gas testing and first aid treatment, basically. You have a MAP person. You have a rear captain who is the communications person to the surface or the fresh air base. And then you have a fresh air base or briefing officer, which is the communications to that team underground. And the team naturally can choose to have 1 or 2 alternates. It doesn't matter, but that's the minimum, is the 6. And most teams will have, you know, 7 or 8 guys per team.
and then layers, many mines possibly have, you know, multiple groups of members depending on shifts and things of that nature or the size of the mine?
Correct, yes. A lot of mines, depending upon the size of the mines, and of course, naturally, not just the size of the physical size of the mines, but the number of persons there, some mines will have up to 3, 4, 5 teams there stationed at that mines, for sure. And, you know, some teams, or excuse me, some mines may just have one team, but they have an associate or neighbor mine that has another team, and they will coexist and support each other.
And with this, you know, you folks are here in town this week doing a training slash competition where you can go out and actually practice and compete with your skills.
Correct.
Amongst one another. Kind of give us a little overview of the training that's involved or what a team needs to do to get prepared for an event of this nature.
Okay. For competition, there's several phases of that. The mine rescue part per se is a field competition. And regardless of the requirements in training to be on the team, for example, at this competition and also the coal competition, and I failed to mention that, coal part of mining has its own rules for competition. Metal, non-metal, which salt, sand, gravel, limestone, potash, those guys are a separate one and they have their own rules, but both groups still have to study a base of material called modules. Those include in-depth studies of surface organization and what goes on, mine gases, ventilation, firefighting techniques, rescue of survivors, exploration, body recovery, mine recovery, because once the fire is over, once the bodies have been removed, mine rescue teams also can get involved in the recovering of the mine to get it back in operation. And each of those modules is aimed at, first of all, team safety, and then survivor or rescue of the survivors and their safety, and then thirdly, the mine recovery. But it's quite an extensive bit of material. There are written examinations on that material that each person has to take a written examination, and also the practical part of it, which is the working on the field. In addition to that, there is a first aid team competition, strictly as a basic EMS first responder, skills and abilities, written exam, practical test for the first aid guys. Also, there is a competition called a team technician, which is new this year. It used to be separated, but it's a bench competition. And when I say that is, it's a practical exam, for example, of your breathing apparatus. In the breathing apparatus competition, that machine is there, and it may have bugs or problems put into it by the judging staff that you would have to go through, test it, and make repairs of anything wrong. Likewise, a gas instrument bench that you have to go through. So it is a very, very extensive bit of training just for the competition, nonetheless, which is part of for the real life also.
And I think that's, you know, almost taking it and comparing it to a military type of a drill where they would have one of their weapons. In this case, your breathing system or your meters are your weapon of choice to protect you.
Correct.
In this case, if you don't have that in-depth knowledge of it and how to make it operate functionally, you are leaving yourself open for some negative outcome. And with this, as the teams compete with each other too, I think one of the greatest things you get from any activity where you bring various teams or groups together, the networking and the ability to learn from one another, share
exactly.
ideas and skills is just, you know, fantastic. We talked a little bit about coal mines and the non-metallic you referred to it as. So does the type of team vary by the type of mine that they would be working at or responding to?
Well, if we spoke basically of coal, there's one thing that a lot of people forget, and is that their environment will burn. You know, if there's a fire in a coal mine, you know, we know that coal burns. And it's not just a piece of equipment or a conveyor system or whatever. That environment can burn, and that creates some hazards within itself. Metal, non-metal mines, on the other hand, for example, most of the mines in our association are salt mines. Salt is a great extinguishing agent. The fire there would be, of course, a piece of equipment or a conveyor system. So with that being said, there are still some things that do not change. Methane gas has an explosive range of 5 to 15%, whether it exists in a metal, non-metal mine or a coal mine. So there are a lot of basic procedures that are the same. Your exploration procedures are basically the same. Making sure the team is safe, exploring behind you and to the side of you before you move ahead. So I guess to say, does the type of mine, you may have to deal with a specific gas more in one type of mine than you would another, for example, the methane. But a lot of the basic mine rescue procedures are the same, regardless of the mine.
Okay. And at an event like this, you said it's you blend different people. The events vary. I know from having the pleasure of doing some training with different mine teams over the years, these competitions are worldwide. That this is taken very serious across the entire industry.
Correct.
And these teams do travel significant distances to compete and learn
Yes.
from one another. What are some of these big events that you've been involved in?
Well, in coal, those guys have a lot of competitions, and it's just natural that you go to those for the learning experiences. In my career in coal, we traveled and competed in up to 6-7 contests every year. Metal, non-metal, there may be 3 or 4 or 5 that a team gets to go to. The mines are much more spread out in metal, non-metal. For example, we are from northeastern Ohio, and we're up here in Rochester for this competition, which is a pretty good little distance. In the state of Ohio, there are only 2 salt mines. And if you go further west or north, you've got a couple of mines. And then from there, you move west of the Mississippi to the larger underground potash, those kinds of mines. And again, the coal is sort of together. A lot of mines in the various coal-producing states. So the guys actually get to participate a lot more there. And in essence, because of the problems that exist, the hazards exist, the companies support that tremendous for those guys to go compete and to learn, in addition to their monthly training that's required.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing that the industry sees the value of what you folks are doing and puts the investment into, you know, their production, but the safety of the folks who come every day to produce the product and make them successful.
Right.
We talked a little bit about special equipment, the breathing equipment, meters you would use, probably very similar to what a hazmat person would be accustomed to bringing
Correct.
To an incident with them. Your distances you have to travel are much greater, or the demand for your efforts. Are there any specialized equipment that would be a crossover from the traditional fire service, or things that people have evolved as the need rose?
Well, from a traditional firefighter point of view, I see in history, most recently in the few years past, of the use of, for example, fans on the surface. A lot of people have seen the movie Flashback or Backdraft and those kinds of things. In coal, we recognized early on the problems that would occur in a tunnel, if you will, of the fire in that tunnel, that it can control that ventilation, it can stop it, it can cause it to baffle itself, it can even reverse it. And the buildup of the fire gases, which is what the movie Backdraft was dealing with, the flashovers, people in mine rescue learned that. But as far as basic equipment, if you go in a mine, you're going to have some type of communications. And that has developed tremendously over the years. As far, you know, the normal firefighters would have. But basically, it's the use of any mobile transportation in a mine to get to a location that where you would start on foot. But if that's not available, you start from the surface, either going down a drift opening into the side of a mountain or down a shaft or down a slope incline into the mine. But once you're there, there's not a lot of difference. If the mine in its normal operation, for example, has water lines, most every coal mine has water lines, the team would work to train on the use of firefighting equipment through a water line. Other than that, it's going to be normal extinguishing agents. Some mines have purchased special foam machines that have self-contained volumes of water. You know, I purchased some of those for our mine to produce and use the high-quality foam. But, you know, there's not a lot of difference to say. It's just the event that you're dealing with and what you have to deal with it at that point in time.
It's almost like taking a ship fire, which is a very challenging event because of the constraints and the compartments and the limited accessibility to it, to the next level, where here you're, you know, below the surface. Your equipment now, is this equipment staged in the mine itself, or are there like bunkers or storage buildings on the top side, or how would you have your equipment available?
Most of the equipment in many mines is in a central location. Other than that, the normal fire extinguishing units, fire extinguishers, fire suppression is required on a lot of equipment. And if that's not available, you know, I keep going back to coal because that was a major part of my experiences with the water lines. And, you know, that is stored in specific locations. Your hoses are folded properly, identification where they are in metal, non-metal. Again, going back to the fire suppression units, the fire extinguishers, and should that mine have purchased and trained their guys to use the foam machines, you know, that are either air-driven or water-supplied for that. But it's pretty much, some of it's going to be stored, but then you're going to have to make arrangements to take some of it with you if need be.
So you were looking at something that's, no matter where it's at within the facility, the first phase is just a very labor-intensive operation to get everything up and deployed, especially in the larger mines where you could have significant distances of travel from the shafts and the different offshoots. So we can see where the efficiency of practicing and working together is so important. When we get to the competition, you kind of covered earlier the different aspects of it, the bench testing for the equipment. In the EMS component of it, what are some of the things a competitor would be faced with during that segment of the competition?
Okay. In the field practical part of the competition, not only is it consistent of a team exploring through established rules, et cetera, but also when they do find a survivor, is an examination of that person and basic EMS skills to treat that person, carrying, again, basic EMS stuff up to and including an extra breathing apparatus, which will provide oxygen as a regular EMS person would utilize. And that would be the practical part of it. But a lot of people, it's not just mine rescue. It's sort of a combination of an EMS, firefighter, search person, all three rolled into one, and all the training relates to those three. I failed to mention another piece of equipment there a while ago is the use of the cameras to be able to detect infrared cameras. Are available, and that's a big advancement. Sorry, I mentioned that.
I think we can see in all the different aspects of firefighting, you know, technology has been very good to us the last few decades.
Bringing
equipment and skills. The meters you have today, probably less than 10 years ago, wouldn't even have come close to what you have on the shelf. The thermal imaging capabilities, you know, we in the structural firefighting world do have the luxury of a relatively simple process of ventilation and clearing the air for visual searches short periods of time into the incident. In a mine, there are no luxuries of opening a few windows, setting up a few fans,
correct,
and instantly having it. So I could really see where that's a major plus to the individuals working in these environments. Obviously, site familiarity is big. Individuals work in these locations.
Right.
They know the layout intimately. They go to work there daily. This is a secondary activity that they've, you know, stepped up to and volunteered to be part of. The actual team groupings, when you're in the competitions, you said there's anywhere five or six individuals together. What would a scenario be that they would be faced with as a group event at one of the competitions?
Okay, and I can just give examples of some of the problems that I design in training. Let's say, for example, at one of the salt mines, the Cargill mine here, the American Rock Salt team that's in New York here, and the two salt mines in Northeast Ohio, is you have a shaft that's your normal entrance to that mine. There may be more than one shaft, and there usually is, one for intake air, return air, and production. Your product has to come outside that mine. That team may be faced with a mine fire. They have to go in and deal with that fire, either try to extinguish it or to try to seal the fire for controlling of the fire. They may have missing persons. And if there had been some type of an explosion, A, through blasting agents or compressed cylinders or other incidents such as roof falls, fall of ground, people trapped there, their skills have to be able to deal with each of those. And then it comes to a barricade. Live person survivors have seen the need to say, okay, we're not going to be able to get out of here, so we have to barricade ourselves in. So then they're in good air on the inside, and the contamination outside may be a toxic gas, oxygen deficiency, the particulates and so forth involved in smoke. That mine rescue team has to devise a means to be able to bring fresh air from the surface by ventilation controls up to where that barricade is to get those persons out. Because if there's one person there, you may be carrying a one single apparatus, but if there are five or six there, no team is carrying five or six apparatus. So you have to bring the fresh air to them and ventilate the noxious toxic gases away so you can open that barricade and get those gentlemen out, or ladies, whomever's involved.
So it sounds like the mine environment itself, stepping away from the rescue teams, just the training as an employee in one of these facilities is very intense. It's almost like you're a secondary phase of the mine rescue team just by working there, because you need to have certain skills for self-survival.
Yes, that is involved in the required training of new miners in the mining industry, ventilation, ground control, self-safety, which includes how to barricade, how to do those things. And a lot of people mistake, you know, they don't understand, for example, if people will go back to 2006 in northern West Virginia at the Sago mine, when that explosion occurred, people did not, you know, the normal public didn't understand, why did those guys barricade in the mines? Why didn't they start outside? It was only 1,500 feet or whatever. Well, that's the training that those miners received, because they tried to get out, couldn't get out. So they said to themselves, now we have to barricade in and hope the mine rescue team comes and finds us.
And I think that's one of the things that happens so many times in a specialty area such as mining, where the general public, we get our evening snippets of news or throughout the course of the day on the various major news networks, and
right,
they're putting a twist on it much different than what actually is going on in there. And when you have the opportunity to speak with someone of your background and other individuals involved in these different professions and in different rescue groups, it really opens your eyes that there's a much broader and bigger picture that
exactly.
these folks are doing. And sometimes it's nice to take a few minutes to sit and get the details, at least a few of them, so you have a better picture of just
right.
what a challenge these folks are facing.
Well, you know, I wanted to have something to say at the end of our interview, but this is an appropriate time to say that. And I will not take anything away from our folks in the military. I've been there. I will not take anything away from our firefighters and our police forces and so forth. And we often relate, the public sees the term hero associated with those guys. But, you know, I've been in mining so long, in mine rescue, and I just want to say for all those folks, they're heroes also, because they're volunteers. They're not paid to do this. They're willing to sacrifice themselves and their fellow team members to rescue or help someone that's in need. And all too often, they don't get the heroic attributes that are provided to some of others. And I've seen that over time. But, you know, you go into mines that have exploded, smoke, fire and brimstone, if you will. Those guys are putting their life on the line, and it is a very dangerous operation.
And I think you covered it extremely well on that point. I know from having had the opportunity to provide training for a mine rescue team in our region, the ability to spend some time with these individuals, they are a family. These guys and girls work together intimately on their day-to-day basis, where they provide their normal skill sets for
yes.
the corporation. But when they come together to train, they're faced with some serious challenges that they know they have to be prepared for. And the hours and the effort they put into it is, you know, very impressive. And you're right, sometimes things are overshadowed by mainstream media. I think the large urban centers get
right.
more media because that's where media lives. Many of our mines are in small, more rural or remote locations. So unless it is the tragedy that goes on for multiple days that brings in the satellite trucks and all
right.
the waves of media, they don't get the recognition they deserve. And the nice thing is with an event like this, they get internal recognition. I know when the event was here a year ago, there was some excellent media coverage in a local newspaper that really showed what these individuals were doing. And having talked to a few of them after that event, they took great pride in that people took the time to come and talk to them and
right.
listen about what they had to do, what they do in their own private world, basically. One of your, you know, many activities, being on the board for the National Mine Rescue Association, what does the association do, or how does it represent its folks?
Well, the national organization begins to deal with issues of questions that are out there, research, deal with recommendations to legislature on, you know, advancement of certain things for real life. Most don't really deal with competition rules. I know our local association here, the Northern Mine Rescue Association, we try to have an effect on competition rules per se, so that they lend themselves and tend to be more toward the real life scenarios. But the National Association is into research, those kinds of things, working with NIOSH, providing suggestions, and it's a vast body of knowledge that's there in that group of people. A lot of those guys are a lot older than I am, and they're still active and participating. And, you know, that's the thing there, is to provide the continuity of the knowledge, because as people pass on and move on in their life, retire, get away from the industry, you know, you lose a body of knowledge. And that's what National Association tries to deal with, meetings, what they call veterans of mine rescue, who have been in many, many instances of rescue work. And like I say, to provide information that can be used for training down the road for future mine rescue team members.
And I like the idea that there is a formal system within the organization that respects and honors the elder statesmen, per se, the people who got us to where we are today. And I think that's all part of that paying it forward and mentoring the next generation. We need to have across the board in all of emergency services, our lead individuals of today are not going to be there every day in the future. Eventually they will rotate it out, and it's very refreshing to hear that, especially the Mine Rescue Association, taking that task on and creating a formal infrastructure where they can help build for the future.
Well, one of the things that I've seen in the mining industry, I saw it in coal, and I see it in the metal, non-metal industry, and most specifically, not just the general industry itself, but related to mine rescue. You know, there are basic techniques, basic procedures that are there, but sometimes we see people, and I'm not wanting to beat those people up, but a lot of times it's not their fault. They progress through the normal advancement procedures, if you will, get promoted, move to a job, given an assignment to do this and that, and they may not be prepared for that because they don't have the background or the history or the knowledge to deal with that. So here they are in this position, and at the same time, the older gentlemen, if you will, or persons that have a vast array of experiences, as you said, mentoring does not take place a lot of times, and those people go by the wayside. Therefore, you know, what happened to this body of knowledge? And people sometimes get put in decision-making positions that they're not fully equipped to do because, A, there was no mentoring, or nobody really looked at what the requirements of the position was.
And that has to be a big challenge. It kind of echoes what I've heard from many people I've had the pleasure to speak with through various aspects of the emergency response communities. And it's one of the areas where professional development is more than our EMS skills, more than our team deployment skills.
Correct.
But we need to mentor and develop that development of our leadership people, our willingness to keep us moving forward.
Right, and a very good example of it is, you know, in training with my guys and all the training I've done in mine rescue is the fact that most companies, there's a lot going on out there, and there has been some before 9/11, but that seemed to be an impetus to get things started or revived, if you will. Emergency response plans, emergency response development for sites, for companies, for whatever it is. And when you sit down and you look at the assigned duties and designate this person or this person or this person, and that's their job, just because a guy, for example, is a human resources person doesn't mean that's the guy that, if you have to talk to the media, should talk to the media. You know, just because this guy is a general manager doesn't mean he's the guy that could be in charge. He may fall to pieces in an emergency. Likewise, the designations of what goes on and the duties have to be closely correlated to the staff you have. And then if that staff member retires, moves on, gets promoted, then we're back to the mentoring, and there goes that body of knowledge with that person that nobody has captured.
And that's key. I've seen that in the various groups that I've been associated with during training, that they really focus on the new member, per se, that there's always the lighthearted enjoyment of each other's time when they're together, the typical practical jokes everyone seems to enjoy playing on each other. But once it comes time for the actual training and they hit the field out of the classroom environment, you see almost a transformation where they know that this person is a key element, and that it's also very obvious when you watch them train together how they focus on one another, knowing that not only would you be there to assist another member of the company or the team itself, but you yourself are going to benefit if something
Correct.
Goes wrong.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, with this, type of an environment. You know, I'm glad we had a chance to get together and speak briefly today. Hopefully in the future we can talk a little bit more. Any closing thoughts or things that you might want to start wrapping up today's session with, Rick?
Well, like I say, I started Mine Rescue in 1971, and a short while after that left the mining industry and went back into an initial chosen profession of teaching and coaching, and that didn't work out, and I went back into mining and have been involved in mining ever since. But the mine rescue people that are out there that I've met over the years are some of the most special people, the best quality people that I've come across. There's a saying that we sometimes utilize on the back of logos or hats that, you know, mine rescue people are a special breed. And, you know, I just want to say thanks to all the people out there that would hear this interview, that know a mine rescue team member or know what's going on, is to recognize the fact that, again, like I said, those guys are heroes. They're volunteers. They're very willing to give up their safety to be involved in securing the safety of someone else. And it's also, as I said before again, it's a combination of EMS service, firefighter service, and rescue and recovery service all rolled in to that one guy that you're seeing there. And they are special people. And I do appreciate, Bob, the opportunity to chat with you today to hopefully foster a little bit more respect and support for mine rescue teams throughout the country.
You know, I can pretty much just echo everything you just wrapped the session up with, that it is a part of our rescue community that's often overlooked or forgotten. And it was nice to have the opportunity to meet you, get together, speak a little while, and hopefully share some background to some of our listeners may have never had the opportunity to get this deep of an insight from someone with your collected experience in the profession. This is Bob Dumel, your host for the Buzz on Technical Rescue. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Remember, be safe, and we'll be talking to you soon.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.